So this bundle of emotions, right? I'm going for a job of a lifetime. Yeah. My mom had, at that point, had passed away just a couple months before that. And then I also had to like focus for a job interview before I could take my dad to see if he can live a little longer. So that was a strange day.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly, a podcast that explores the intersectionality of racial identity, culture, and class through the lens of immigrant experiences. Before we begin our episode, a quick reminder that we have GoFundMe set up. Please donate whatever you feel comfortable donating. Your donations help us keep the lights on here. Every dollar counts. You can get the link on our website at immigrantlypod.com. And now to our guest for the show. Donnie Khan is a senior marketing director at National Hockey League. He's part of Indivisible Westchester County. Indivisible is a nationwide movement of thousands of volunteer-led local groups that engage in progressive advocacy and electoral work at the local, state, and national levels. Initially from Pakistan, Donnie demonstrates contagious optimism in his work and life, and I'm pretty sure Donnie can tell his story far better than I can. So without further ado, let's get into it. Welcome, Donnie. Welcome to my show. So good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Sadia. This is great.
So we'll start with your parents. Both of them came from very different backgrounds, and your dad's family lived on Pakistan's side of the border at the time of partition of 1947. Your mother's family migrated from India. Did that inform their understanding of the world, and how did it facilitate your move to the U.S.?
That's a great question, first of all, and I think you know, it was interesting, and I think just to kind of give the listeners a quick background. So my parents, my dad's side of the family was already on the Pakistani side, as you said, and the family was established. They had a business. They were in the shoe retail business. Khan Shoes was the business on their side. And on the other side, my mom's family was on the India side, and my grandfather had textile farms or factories. And when the whole partition happened, mom's family had to leave everything that they had in India, and they had to essentially, it was, through their Hindu friends who actually hid them in the back of a truck and helped them escape India to Pakistan. So the thing that happened on my mom's side was a sort of a story of survival and strong will, and my grandmother really had a lot to do with it on my mom's side. She really hunkered down, and you know, my grandfather actually passed away soon after moving to Pakistan too, so my grandmother was left with five kids, four daughters and a son, and she really made sure that they got to school and they went to college and they got their degrees, and I mean, that was at a time that, you know, a lot of people were thinking even of going to college, but the fact that she had four daughters and she sent them to school and sent them to college was an accomplishment in itself.
Absolutely,
and it was there. My mom eventually became a biology professor at the University of Karachi, and my dad was an English literature professor there. Mm-hmm. So they actually ended up meeting, falling in love, and at a time, you know, sort of arranged marriages. They kind of got their families to marry the person that they love rather than something that was planned in ahead of schedule. So but that sort of really helped define their worldview. And my dad, on the other side, was very influenced by Western culture. So he wanted to go study in the U.S. or study in England. And he was constantly trying to get his dad or my grandfather to send him. And my grandfather kind of felt like, you know, that was a big deal back then. So he didn't get a chance to do that. But he became, you know, sort of immersed himself in Western culture, and he became an English literature professor. He always had, like, books in his house, in our house, on every topic that you can imagine. So between the two of them, like, I think that kind of sort of brought together this understanding that there is people outside your bubble in your own circle, I think. And that sort of, you know, opened us up to Western culture to eventually move here to the U.S.
So, Donnie, your father had never visited the U.S., but he was so enamored with Western ideals and Western culture. Why do you think that was the case?
You know, you're right. He had never visited. And it was funny for us because when we were kids, always tell stories of the West, and it was almost like he had lived here all his life. But because he had read so many books and he had watched so many movies and he had sort of immersed himself in that culture, I think he also, part of it also had to do with the fact that he was a sort of a free-spirited, free thinker. He was more of an artist type. So he, you know, he drew, he painted, he sketched. He even would go and find, like, clay, and he would create, like, statues and things like that, which I had a lot of fun watching him do that. That by itself just kind of lent itself to, like, well, there's this whole world outside that you can go and do this, you know, all the time. And it sort of encouraged and it sort of inspired him a little bit. I think that was probably a lot to do with that.
And your parents' family, especially your dad's family, was pretty well off in Pakistan, right? Yeah. They led a very comfortable life.
Yeah.
And then your dad decides to come to the U.S. later in life. Do you think what triggered him to make that decision? And again, what you told us about your dad, he was just like, he had this idea of America, a utopian society,
yeah,
at least a utopian experiment, to say the
least.
How was reality different from what he had expected when, or what he envisioned when he was in Pakistan?
Yeah. And, you know, it was funny because what sort of prompted the move eventually for us to move to the U.S., I think we came to a conclusion that life would be, so in Pakistan, you know, politically things were shifting.
Hmm.
So my dad grew up at a time when we had a duly elected prime minister. He was overthrown by a military dictator and, you know, a lot of unrest and all that. And at the same time, we had an aunt who had moved here, was a citizen. So we'd always talked about the kids would get a better education, have a better future if we moved to the U.S. But my dad never really, both my mom and my dad, because they were, you know, they were entrenched. It's hard, hard to kind of move to a different country. He was about 50 by the time we moved here. My mom was around 40. So I actually sort of prompted the move. Like, we came here, we came to visit the U.S. in 1983. And
so how old were you when you first visited the U.S.?
When I first visited, I was about 11.
Hmm.
We loved it. And then we went back to Pakistan, and then we came to visit again in 86, 87. And somewhere, so I was about 13 and a half, something like that, almost 14. And I decided to make a move. And I said, you know, we always talk about moving to the U.S. and unless one of us takes a bold step, it's never going to happen. And
so you were just a kid who decided to do this.
It sounds so crazy. I have two kids now, and it sounds so crazy to me now. But I don't think that might have been the bravest or the boldest thing that I've done in my life at, like, I think at around 13 or 14. But aunt, who had three daughters, she kind of saw me as a son that she never had. So she was on board with the idea. She was like, sure, leave him here. And, you know, and I had bad asthma and, you know, I was seeing Doc, you know, when I was younger. So I was like, you know, he'll get good care. He'll get good education. You guys can go back and then come back when you've settled your affairs and then move here. And it was only going to be for a little bit. And then they went back. And you know how it takes a long time to sell your house and, you know, take care of your business and make sure you make the move and all that. So 2 years went by before they kind of came back, and this was before the internet and, you know, cell phones and things like that. So there's no Skype or FaceTime. So basically letter writing and the long distance phone calls that you have to kind of plan that you're going to call at this time. Kind of thing.
What was the most difficult part of staying away from your family for those 2 years?
Me, because I was like a kid in a candy store because It was difficult not having my family around, but at the same time, I kind of felt like I was made for this country. I felt like I was taking everything in. I was running around trying to make friends. One of the tougher parts was that my uncle was a very strictly religious person, and I was raised in a household that really wasn't. Now, my dad wasn't very religious. My mom was, but not to the point of, you know, being very hard on us about things.
Yeah.
So that was a tough adjustment for me to be in a country where I want to be running around all the time, meeting people, making friends, and, you know, I'm expected to be like go to prayers all the time and things like that. So that part was the tougher part. 2 years later, my mom and my youngest brother moved here, and about a year or so after that, my dad and my two sisters. Mm-hmm. So like eventually, our whole family moved here.
So what was the most difficult part of transition for your dad and your mom?
interestingly, that's where their backgrounds, I felt like, really came through, because my mom was always a worker. So when I was born, she was a professor, and then she sort of started teaching at the high school level because she wanted more time at home with the kids. And she never, just a selfless person. She just worked nonstop. And when she came here, she didn't really care about what degrees she had, or, you know, much like a lot of immigrants that come to this country, she just wanted to make sure that she was providing for her family. And so she became a cashier at the store that my aunt and uncle had. Hmm. And she just worked nonstop. I remember she actually worked without taking a day off for 7 straight years. And I would ask her, I would be like, why? Well, how come you don't take a day off? I mean, even now, Saturdays and Sundays, the days were a little bit shorter because the store was only open so many hours. But she's like, well, you know, I get paid by the hour. And I think that every hour that I don't work, I'm not providing for my family. That's just how she was. And Dad had a little bit of a tougher time because he had grown up in a household that where he was always well off. He had a huge house in Pakistan. He, even though he was a professor, after he was done teaching, he took over the family business, which is like a chain of 3 retail stores. So everyone kind of knew him as Khan Sahib, and, you know, there was like, you know, everything and all the sort of the dealings in Pakistan at his level were always with a handshake, you know, your word is bond, basically, and that sort of thing. And when he moved here, he was 50 years old and never really thought about what a resume might look like or, you know, what you need. And even though he had all these degrees and ran his own business, he wasn't really sure how to put that forward to get a good job. So for the first couple of years, he was pretty depressed. Like, he kind of like went into this thing where he was just quiet and keeping to himself. And he came out and he was looking for a job and everything. When it wasn't happening, he just kind of like shrunk into himself a little bit. He finally got himself together, took basically like, went to one of these temp agencies and just took like a menial job working in a records department of JP Morgan Chase, and eventually became Iron Mountain. So kind of he was comfortable doing that. But I would always say that I can't believe that, you know, this is that you're OK doing this when, you know, you used to write and you used to paint and sculpt and rent your own business. But I think that happens a lot to, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's especially immigrants who come later in life, because who come early, it's very, like, it's relatively easy to adjust, came early. So it's much easier to adjust than. But I can't imagine my parents coming to the U.S. now, because they have such a comfortable life there. And that's something that people don't realize. People always think that immigrants are like, there is this narrative around immigrants. But most of them, in fact, some of them are very comfortable living where they are and the kind of lifestyle that they lead.
Exactly.
Donnie, talking about hockey, that's your passion.
Yes.
And this goes back, you are working as a marketing director for NHL right now, but this goes way back.
Yes.
Can you give, and your American experience is very much tied to your passion for hockey and your love for hockey. Can you give us context for that?
Yeah, and, you know, it's a strange thing when you think about it that that a 14-year-old from Pakistan would fall in love with hockey, right? And I think for me, first moved here and I was on my own.
But we do have hockey in Pakistan. It's a different kind of hockey.
Yeah, field hockey. That's right. We do have field hockey. But, you know, when I moved here, those 2 years that I was by myself before my mom and my brother moved, kind of trying to find myself, right? I was trying to fit in. I was trying to make friends. And I was also, even though I was getting in trouble, I was being very careful. I knew that I was inside. I was smart enough to know that, hey, my parents aren't here. I'm 14 years old. I have to kind of watch out for myself, and I have to make sure that the friends I make are not, you know, too bad of an influence on me, which, thinking back on all that, just all sounds a little surreal now. But in that time, I was following American sports, and I wanted to learn all the American sports and all that. But I also didn't want to be sort of a bandwagon guy. So I figured everybody liked football. Everybody liked baseball. I was like, and then I came across hockey. And I remember back in those days, they would just put the Rangers game on free TV whenever the Knicks were playing too. So just it was on a channel that we normally didn't even get, but I was watching it. And I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then I just got hooked into it, and I started watching hockey games. And then I would work at my aunt and uncle's store after school, And I would come back, and I would, in the summertime, I would make my aunt drop me off at hockey camp. God bless her for driving me there every morning, picking me back up. And in the wintertime, I started, you know, all my friends that had ponds, you know, got to know all the people who had ponds in our, we had about three ponds in our little town of Pawling, New York. And we started playing pond hockey. When the rollerblades first came out, like my brother and I went and got some rollerblades, and then my friends Anthony and Bruce, and we all end up getting rollerblades and roller hockey in the school parking lots. And it just kind of grew. We convinced the town to actually start a roller hockey league for little kids. So even when I went away to college, I would come back and coach little kids in the summertime with roller hockey. And I went to Plattsburgh State for communications. And one of the reasons I went there is that they had a good hockey team and their communications program. So I did play-by-play for the Plattsburgh Cardinals hockey team on radio and then TV as well. So passion was there. And I think it's sort of a, you know, I'm so grateful that now I'm actually working at the NHL, which is something that I would have never have thought of when I was like 14,
so how did 15. That happen? How did you end up with NHL?
So after college, I pretty much was trying for like 10 years to get into the NHL. And I would apply to anything that opened up, and I would never hear back. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people who are trying to get in. And I worked in advertising in New York. After college, I stayed at home for like a year, commuted into the city, and then eventually saved up enough money to move, move to the city. And I would apply for anything that would open up, either with the Rangers and the Islanders or the NHL themselves, and I wouldn't hear anything back. And then about just go by, and I was like, all right, you know, I've tried enough. I think it's time to give up on this.
You were persistent.
Yes, I tried. And then 2008, possibly the worst time of my life. It was my mom passed away from cancer in May of 2008, and about 3 weeks after she passed away, we found out that my dad had lung cancer. Oh. And he had four. They had given him 4 months to live, and that was a time that we couldn't. It was hard to kind of function, right? Like it's we don't have a lot of relatives except for my aunt and uncle at the time, and he's just getting over the mom passing, and then you find out that your dad's dying, and then my dad had no interest. My mom was a fighter. My dad was like, you know, she's gone, and I don't want any treatments. I just want to go in peace. And he kind of saw what treatments do to, you know, the chemo and all that. So at this point, completely, at the lowest point in my life, I'm sitting in my at my desk, and I get an email from a friend who said, hey, you know, I know you're a big hockey fan, so I thought I'd pass this on. I don't know if you're still interested. So I look at the email, and it's a job posting, essentially, and the NHL had gotten a new chief operating officer who had sort of revamped the marketing team, and they had posted this job. And before they posted it widely, they sent the person who is now my direct supervisor had sent an email to a few people in the advertising business to see if there's somebody fit this description. I took it, and I was like, well, you know, this is strange. You know, this is for all the times that I've been trying, and now this comes up. So I decided to instead of writing a cover letter that I'd been sending, you know, sort of like the form, the regular form cover letter, I decided to write from my heart and what hockey means to me and what my experience was like and what they should be doing to promote the game and make it bigger and sort of put the players on a pedestal. And, you know, those are the players are the ones that sort of they're so different than most sports, and you know, they're modest and humble and strong, and they have like a code of ethics and conduct. And so I put all that down in this long-winded email, and I didn't hear anything for several weeks. I was like, all right, well, there goes another one, you know. And then I finally get a call or I get an email back saying, hey, you know, you have a great story. Why don't you come in and talk to us? So I went in, and that day was also a very strange one because that was also a day that I was scheduled to take my dad for a second opinion at Sloan Kettering to see if there was going to be any chance for them to do something for him. So this bundle of emotions, right? I'm going for a job of a lifetime.
Yeah.
My mom had at that point had passed away just a couple of months before that. And then I also had to like focus for a job interview before I could take my dad to see if he can live a little longer. So that was a strange day. Yeah, I got into the city, and I tell you, it was, but once I got in there and started talking about hockey, everything kind of felt normal for a while, which was really, really nice. And supposed to be there for like 1 hour, meeting with one or two people. And next thing I know, I was there for like 3 hours, end up meeting with like the head of marketing and HR, and all those people came out. And it just felt natural and normal to be talking about hockey and how to grow the game and how to promote the game. And I left, and I remember my sister met me in the Upps Ferry so I can pick up my dad and then drive him back into the city to Sloan Kettering. And then for 3 months, I didn't hear anything back from them. So I was like, well, I was checking in, and they were like, hey, you know, we're still thinking about it, and, you know, we're just a little bit slow. And I remember because my dad was kind of on his last few days, and one of our cousins from Pakistan came to visit him, and we all went to the airport to pick him up. And as we were driving back, phone call, and I put on the speakerphone, it was like the head of marketing and the person who was now my boss calling, say, hey, we'd like to make you an offer. And I think we were thrilled. That was an amazing day.
That's an amazing story. Yeah. How has hockey changed since you joined in terms of diversity within the field? Have you made any strides in making that possible?
Yeah, you know, actually, when I first got here, I was literally the second person that was hired in this new marketing department. Mm. So the first couple of years, I focused entirely on sort of like promoting the brand of the National Hockey League, raising our profile, improving the creative product. We did a great job of that. But the last 3 or 4 years, once that sort of kind of was set and now we have a full marketing team that's dedicated to making sure that the brand is thriving, but focusing on some of the cause and community and diversity and inclusion programming. And 2 years ago, we hired Kim Davis, who is our executive VP of a department called SGL, which is Social Impact, Growth, and Legislative Affairs. And I still sit on the marketing team, but I work directly with her. And we have really focused on making hockey more accessible. Mm. Because I think, you know, I think my story is proof directly that you don't really, you know, anyone can play hockey. We always say hockey is for everyone. And that's truly sort of where my story comes in. And so we always used to have Hockey Fights Cancer, and we always had Hockey is for Everyone programming at the NHL, but we've really grown it in the last couple of years. So last year, we did our first full Black History Month in February. We did a first Gender Equality Month in March. We did a Pride Month in June. This year, we're also adding Hispanic Heritage Month. And I think for a long time, I think we struggled with the fact that hockey is, the players are predominantly white. So does that give us the license, or do we have the license to go and sort of open the game up to other minorities and people of color and a more diverse audience? And I think our philosophy is that you don't have to, like, anyone can like and love and play the game, and that you have to show people and you have to find those stories to let people feel more comfortable, because I think people need to see other people like them, even if it's not at the NHL level. And I think, for example, there is a tournament coming up in Florida coming weekend where this gentleman started this, working with the Florida Panthers, and he invites teams from Latin American countries to come and participate in this 2-day. And so you have hockey teams, ice hockey teams from Mexico and Chile and Argentina and Brazil.
You
wouldn't expect it. And I think, you know, my job now is to make sure that we find these stories and we tell these stories so that people, when they see it, they realize that hockey is not this, you know, exclusive sport, that this anyone can play it and everyone is welcome.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about Indivisible. You are actively involved in Indivisible Westchester. You played an important role in creating their podcast. I was listening to one of the episodes. Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
And in one of the episodes, you were talking about how you would give like thumbs down to people who are very critical of potential hopefuls. Why do you think people should not be critical?
Right now, we are in the, you know, I can't find a proper analogy for it, but I feel like it's we're in a stage where our house is on fire and we don't want to be fighting about which water is best to put it out, that sort of thing. You know, I think that Part of it is the media, right? Like, I think when you have 20-something candidates, hopefully by the next debate, things will, you know, are starting to dwindle down a little bit.
Are we down to 10 now? I've lost count.
I think we're down to 10. And I think, I don't think we realize that how entrenched we get in our positions when we start to criticize, because people have their favorites, right? And I think it's easy enough to say, hey, you know, oh, you know, Biden's leading right now, but I really think it should be Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, when we saw that with Bernie Sanders, I felt like there was a lot of Bernie Sanders voters who kind of couldn't get themselves to get fired up about Hillary Clinton when she became the nominee, even though Bernie himself was saying, you know, I'm all in for Hillary, go vote for her.
Yeah, but Donnie, here's my concern with that. I feel like it's so important to flush out any weak narratives that they may have or any policy proposals that are not going to work, because they're facing very friendly audience.
Yeah.
They will be facing much harsher criticism and audience in future. And for me, it is so important that I know who will best represent me. So for that, I should look at Biden's record, and I should be able to criticize what Kamala Harris did with, like, when she was general, yes, yeah. Right? So I think all of that should matter, because I think in 2016 elections, what we missed out was we weren't as stringent. Had we been as stringent with, say, Hillary Clinton, things may have been different. Who knows, right? Because everybody had already assumed that she was the establishment candidate and she was the so-called quote-unquote electable.
Yes.
Which, again, I completely disagree with, because electability in the U.S. right now, you don't know who is electable anymore. So that's where I'm coming from. I feel like it's important that we do that so that we can flush out people who we think are not representative of our values.
I don't disagree with that. I think where I come from, which I wish the Democratic Party did more of, and maybe it's the marketer in me that sort of thinks this way, but, you know, the Democratic Party and this Democratic establishment, sort of they have this mentality that what's going on the outside and what should we do to react to it? And maybe that's a good way to govern, right? And if you're governing anything, you should want to know what's happening in the country and then react to the needs of the people. But for this election period, where you need to win something, right? It's almost like as with my marketing advertising background, where it's more almost like you're trying to sell a product. The Republicans do a much better job of worrying less about what everybody's saying right now and what they're going to make them say or think down the road. So,
yeah, but in 2016 elections, there were a lot of Republicans, and a lot of them were critical of each other as well. So there was a lot of vetting process going on through even before primaries. And that's where Democrats
came up with Trump.
They did. But my point is, that's what they did.
Yeah. No, I think the vetting process is good. And I think we want to make sure that we understand what each candidate is doing and where they're bringing everything from. But I also don't think that they are vastly different from each other at this point. I mean, for the most part, as far as equality goes, as far as climate goes, you know, general foreign policy, there is not healthcare, education. Mm-hmm. There isn't a vast divide between the different candidates. So my fear is just that given that we don't want to put somebody in there that we don't think is qualified, but I don't think there's anybody on our side that wouldn't already be head and shoulders above Trump. But again, I would go, and I also think that, you know, this whole thing is that whoever it is, we have to put forward such a strong argument for them that there's no question that that's the right person.
Do you have any favorites?
You know, I have a lot. Actually, I have a lot. And, you know, I'm going to do something exactly what I say. Everybody shouldn't be doing. But I love that Joe Biden is leading still. I wish he had run like 5 years ago even, or 10 years ago. I think Elizabeth Warren is my early favorite right now. But Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker even. Like, I feel like all those are much stronger and smarter candidates than you know. Bernie, I loved Bernie in 2016. I went to a few of his rallies and speeches, and I voted for him in the primary. But I feel like Bernie and Joe, and I'm contradicting what I was saying, I feel obviously if they were to be the candidates, I would vote for them. But I feel like we have such a strong crop that's a little bit on the younger side and has, and also has, you know, Elizabeth Warren. She has really won me over.
But she's not that young. We think
yes, she's
is.
Not. No,
you know, it's like it's the energy that she brings, but she's not that young.
Yeah, and it's a different perspective.
Right?
We haven't had, you know, Hillary has opened up this. You know, I don't think Hillary Clinton gets the credit that she deserves for opening up the field on the Democratic side for so many women to step up and. You know, to the point where it's not even a thing anymore, right? And it is still a challenge for them. It's always harder for a woman or any minority to be trying to push through, but it is a lot less of a debate, you know. And there's still, I still run into people who say, oh, not sure if we can elect a woman to be president or not sure if we'll elect another.
It surprises me.
Yeah. And I'm like, if you are running against Trump and you can't, if you think anyone can't be him, then you should not be part of this process at all.
Donny, in terms of Muslim involvement in national discourse around politics and advocacy, do you see a shift in the current Democratic Party from treating Muslims as tokens to considering them or accepting them as an essential constituency? Have you seen that shift? And how important is that shift for Muslim community?
Well, I think it's very important. I think the shift is happening, but I don't think we're there yet. I think we still have a lot of work to do. And I think, you know, it's interesting for me because just what I was saying earlier is that I'm not a sort of a typical Muslim, right? I'm more of a Muslim culturally than I am religiously. But I am very involved in trying to make sure that the community itself does not get forgotten or has some way to stand up to the constant attacks that come out of this administration. So one of my steering committee members on Indivisible Westchester and I, Farah Khatwari, we had started American Muslims Indivisible, which is a sort of an offshoot of Indivisible Westchester to try to introduce politicians in Westchester and New York State to the Muslim community. And so we rallied and we had, amongst many other things that Indivisible Westchester did, we also had a meet and greet with the Muslim community with George Latimer. And I remember one of the people leaving in the audience said to me, you know, I've been living in Westchester for 30 years. I've never had a politician come and meet with the Muslim community, which I thought was amazing and scary at the same time. We're trying to do that more often. You know, schedules being what they are, and everybody's got full-time jobs and trying to keep going. But I think it's very important to make our voices heard. And I think Muslim community as a whole, well, there's a couple of things. If I go too deep into this, just stop me. But I think our community revolves around the religion, right? And I think that becomes an issue unto itself. So it's been hard for someone like me who doesn't pray all the time to be going, and you know, you have to go into a mosque, and whenever you meet with, if you want to meet with a large group of people, you have to go to a mosque and speak to people there.
But and I think that's something that we see more in American Muslim society, because if you go back to say Pakistan,
yes,
you see all different sorts of Muslims, right? Some will be more devout Muslims, others won't. So there is this broad spectrum of kind of Muslims that you see.
Exactly.
And as you said, it's also important to connect culturally than just on religion, because again, Muslims are not a monolithic group, so there are different cultures, different ideas of what Islam really is. How do you think Muslims can reconcile with that? Because one thing I know for sure, Muslims have terrible PR.
Right.
We need somebody to help us there.
No, I agree. And I think that's sort of bringing forth, and I think like Muslims for Progress is doing a lot of great work with that. And we're working with them a little bit as well. And that's our goal, too, is for American Muslims Indivisible, is to try to focus more on sort of show our culture more, right? And I think we want to get back to the place where there's a million different kinds of Muslim people. They come from 100 different countries. They have, varying levels of religious involvement. That's what we want to put forward. I think that's, the more you expose people to anything, right, the more comfortable you get. I mean, a lot of time right now, A, we're a small number, and B, a lot of people haven't met many Muslims. So I think the more we sort of put our culture out there, introduce people to our culture and our people, I think that only helps. And I think starting with at least for our part, starting with the politicians, I think is a good step to let them know that we have a group that can bring out the votes, can knock on doors, can donate money. Yeah. Those are all things that are important to them.
So talking about culture, you're raising two kids
yes.
in a biracial household.
Yes.
How is that experience like? And how do you reconcile both cultures at home?
You know, it's great. So my wife is Irish Catholic, mm-hmm. and she's American Irish Catholic. And kids, you know, they value both cultures. They love, you know, both my kids have done, you know, whenever they have a 9-year-old, actually today is their first day of school. So one is starting fourth grade and one's starting eighth grade. Whenever there is a cultural fair in the school or whenever there's a book report due or an assignment, they love digging into both the Irish and Pakistani cultures to tell that story and to sort of celebrate how these two cultures come together and who they are, which I love. So,
can they eat spicy food?
Not so much. I mean, they can do a little bit, but not a ton.
My kids can't eat spicy food. That's especially okay. My older one. She just hates it. Before we wrap up, were to describe America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Go longer than a word, but I just have to tell
you. Absolutely. Go ahead. Yeah.
So this is something that I've thought a lot about mm-hmm. my story, is that it's an interesting story that a 13 or 14-year-old would come to the U.S. and would convince his parents to leave him here and then, you know, then fall in love with hockey, and then, you know, I'm working at the NHL. But the thing that stands out to me, that nowhere else we would do that. And I don't mean in terms of opportunity, right? There's plenty of European countries where you can strive and make a good living for yourself. But there's something about the United States of America, about this country, that gives people so much hope that they can come here and make a good life for themselves, that they can leave their child here and know that everything is going to be okay. And that, to me, is America, that it's not just hope and not just opportunity, but this collection of several things that makes us. And you know, it is exceptional in that way, you know, and
yeah,
I think.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, I think a lot of people these days are forgetting what makes us exceptional. I mean, a lot of people are happy to wave the flags, but they forget what truly makes this country great. And I think that's what this place is to me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Donnie. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sally. I really appreciate it.
Thank you to everyone for listening. Come back next week when we have another inspiring story. And in the meantime, stay connected.